Min campus alihor, miai Karsten Schwine. Nilqakom lura fuq Campus FM u l-program Min Campus Għalihor, miħaj Karsten Xwira. Il-lum il-raba program din is-sens jela għallura mux ħanif għana id-dola ġdida għax issa għalmi forsi sema ta' qabel dra u jekk le nistedimkom jekk tixtiequ taċċessawhom anki online bħala podcast fuq is-sit tal-Campus FM. F'din is-sens jela niltaqa' ma' numru ta' nies li sa ċertu punt huma differenti, sa ċertu punt huma anke simili. Id-differenza tiġi forsi minn dak illi jippratikaw, minn dak illi studjaw, minn dak illi jgħallmu, minn linja partikolari li huma jiżviluppaw. X'qarribhom lejn xulxin, ħafna affarijiet. Hemm id-dimensjoni tal-università, id-dimensjoni tal-campus, illi b'xi mod tagħti isem lil-din is-sens jela, però anke min forsi jaħdem lil-in. Min campus partikolari, anki u stess forsi jgħaddi minn campus għalieħor, ħafna drabi jmiss mad-dinja ħanajdu lajk kemm barra u jkollu xi xogħol illi jittraduċi ruħu f'proġetti partikolari. Ħafna minn dawn il-mistiedin ukoll jivvjaġġaw huma stess. U il-każ tal-lum huwa wieħed partikolari ħafna kelli xorti niltaqa ma' Dr. Anthony Shrag. Il-lum il-ġurnata qiegħed Queen Margaret University ġewwa Edinburgh, ġewwa l-Iskozja, bej l-Iskozja u Malta wkoll kien Malta jagħmel xi riċerka wkoll u fil-fatt mhux ħakunu lku wieħed minn din l-università u minn dan id-dipartiment partikolari fejn huwa senior lecturer fil-management tal-arti u l-politika kulturali. Però fil-każ tiegħu, kif ta' nisimgħu, huwa karattru partikolari, kreattiv ħafna li ħallat il-performattività flimkien ma' riflessjoni teoretika u fil-qosor ħafna nista' ngħidilkom ukoll il-temi prinċipali li hu jqanqluh huma l-kunflitt soċjali, l-antagonizmu, l-kwistjoni tal-etika. U għalhekk meta jgħallem u jagħti tutorials, lectures u jmexxi xogħol l-istudenti tiegħu fil-masters, fl-arti, fil-festivals, fil-management kulturali u anki f'dak li jissejjaħ applied arts kif ukoll social practice ġewwa l-Università ta' Queen Margaret ġewwa Edinburgh, jagħmel dan billi jkun jista' jieħu ħafna mill-esperjenza diretta tiegħu. Fost l-oħrajn kif ħajja ċċennaw ukoll vjaġġa ħafna l-Iżlanda, l-Amerika, l-Kanada fejn qatt kif ftit snin formattivi ta' ħajtu, l-Pakistan u l-Finlandja. Niżel anki l-Afrika t'isfel, ħanajtek. U fil-waqt dejjem kienet idur studja, ir-riċerka, rebaħ numru ta' fondi minn entitajiet diversi u anki numru ta' onuri fostom minn għadiet ġewwa Renju Unit imma anki lil-in Renju Unit. Fatt interessanti fl-2015 kien nexa iktar minn 2500 km minn ħata fuq netta l-Iskozja. Sal-Biennali ta' Venezia. U dan għamlu apparti għaliex u għabliħem attiv ħafna outdoorsi kif ngħidu bl-Ingliż, rrid jesplora il-post fejn l-artist u l-pubbliku jiltaqgħu. Hemm f'rituali, f'spazji, f'relazzjoni u ċertu drabi anki l-bot minn xulxin. U din il-ħaġa tal-parteċipazzjoni, tad-dimensjoni soċjali tal-konflitt. Kif ħadd isimgħu hija qawwija ħafna fix-xogħol tiegħu. Xi ħaġa interessanti wkoll li l-artista Natalie Dubree darba rreferit għalih bħala bla biża ta' xejn fil-waqt li kittieba Marjorie Salona kienet qaltlu Anthony, inti għandek ħafna ideat. Mhux kollha kemm huma tajbin. Il-kif ħadd isimgħu wkoll huwa bniedem għandu umorizmu interessanti ħafna u għalhekk minn ma ntawwa l-wis nislimkom tisimgħu miegħi din intervista. Kull ma ngħid qabel biss kif ġieli nagħmel huwa li nirringrazzja lill-proġett Medinea tal-li provdewna l-mużika matul din is-sensiela. from the introduction which I gave in Maltese about my guest today, we've learned really just a little bit, as happens with many guests who have lots of aspects to their profession, to their career, and also to their personality. And I think today is really a case in point, because Anthony, who I welcome to the show. Thank you for being with me, Anthony.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. I'm honored.
We were joking in preparing for this program over the past few days, how you're in Edinburgh, where it's sort of more at risk of flooding, while I'm in Moscow, where it's more at risk of burning up, really.
Yeah.
Bringing the continent.
And now, hopefully, our conversations can maybe bring a little bit of each other's ecology to each other, to some sort of balance between us.
Oh wow, that would be really good. I look forward to that. Anthony, I'll try to keep my questions to the point, because time is short and a lot to say. But as I said in my introduction, Maltese, there's many aspects to your work as an academic, as a researcher, as a writer, but linking all that with a strong performance element. Possibly, when I say the word performance, our audience might think of what you generally think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Someone on stage, someone on film. But it's not that type. Because somehow I find that you embed yourself with communities, much part of them. We'll have time to give a few quiz as well. And should listeners want to, they can refer to your website.
Yeah.
So really, a lot of it is there and clear. But somehow, because the structure of the program is this way, I wonder whether we could start at the beginning.
Yes.
As I believe Mary Poppins.
I was just about to say, it's a very good place to begin.
And somehow maybe look back a little bit and say, where does this curiosity and this stem from?
Yeah. I think it's a question I sort of probably will struggle with, or maybe struggle is the wrong word. It's a question that I will enjoy asking probably for the rest of my life. I think you're very right to say, I suppose the thing that links a lot of those is a sense of performance. But I might say, instead of performance, something about liveness and something about physicality. And I think I've always been very interested in the notion of a body in space and really feeling that space and being sort of present in that moment. And so a lot of my research and my work all stems from this very kind of performative, very performative experience, but it's more about being live and being in the moment and being a body in that moment. And so, and to go kind of right back to the very beginning, I suppose, I studied when I was in high school, and I did gymnastics, you know, and I wasn't a sporty person in that regard. I didn't play sports, but I really enjoyed those very individualistic physical experiences. And always a big tree climber and very physical. And I suppose as I grew and developed a lot of my thinking, that sense of physicality has always stayed with me. And I actually have a degree in writing, my undergraduate degree. And I, the thing I hated the most about writing was that it is not a physical thing. It's a mental thing. And there was a very strong resistance to that all the way through. And despite loving writing, I really, really do love writing. It isn't a physical, process. And so the sense of physicality and being embedded and present in moments are, I suppose, my initial or my primary responses, I would say.
Uh-huh. So stimuli from environments, from spaces.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I will probably get to it later on. I have a very, very, very strong memory. I grew up in Africa and the Middle East and all the way along, and I have a very, very strong memory of I lived in a compound, and I would spend my days kind of bored teenager running around the wall of this compound. And I just loved the challenge of this running around this wall. But actually, in reflecting on it many, many years later, I was doing something there where I was balancing between two worlds, literally balancing between the white expat community and the local peoples of the countries that I lived in. And I think this kind of moment, this physical balance between these two sites, pushed a lot of my interest in social practice, social engagement, social understandings. And it was from that physical point that I kind of could see, oh, there's a whole bunch of white people doing a certain thing that's colonial and those sorts of things. And there's a whole bunch of people who are dealing with these white people dealing with physical community. And I could see that from my physical vantage point. And so a lot of my work, and even actually if I refer back to my writing, most of my writing is about physical experiences. So that is, I suppose, where it starts from.
It's interesting. This, in a way, you're mentioning this sort of running or walking around, almost exploring the boundaries of a space.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it, you know, that exploring the boundaries is to me will always be a phenomenological thing rather than a conceptual thing. I'm very much in awe of those thinkers who can sit back and you know, unravel things conceptually and in those abstract senses, whereas I kind of want to be on that edge. I want to feel that push of my body against something in a community of people where something might be different. There's some sort of conflict. There's some sort of thing. It to me, it starts with the fingertips and the hands and the feet as opposed to the brain.
And what struck me we had met, I believe, at Queen Margaret University, where you lecture and research maybe a couple of years ago before the pandemic struck. And then I think also in Malta, when I think I actually saw you present your work, also the visual and audiovisual work, which you did from that work. And this, well, I guess it's your interest, it's your curiosity, which you're sort of unraveling now, which is somehow not satisfied with just being physical.
Mm-hmm.
Or just aging in a cerebral think it out approach, but you actually live it and reflect upon it and write about it and then go all the way back to aging practice again.
Yeah, and I mean that's the ideal. I wish it was as simple as you described it, that process. But you know, that is you're absolutely right. You know, it's those immediate experiences that happen in the body, and not just my body. Like, I'm interested in when my body interfaces with another group of people, and then kind of trying to understand that, because the, you know, like a dancer, it doesn't really have a language. You know, physical interactions don't really have a language. So then stepping back from that and going, what was that? How do I understand that? How do I fit that in a different, larger, broader understanding? And then reflecting on that, and it affects research, and that kind of does grow to a little bit more cerebral, abstracted, academic process. But the best stuff does feed right back into it. You know, I think my interest in conflict has always been based on that, and then going away and thinking about conflict and then coming back and trying different types of conflict. You know, and even when it's not with other people, you know, I've been doing I call it a secret research project for about the last 20 years, where I try and basically physically fit myself into different spaces. But you know,
how is that going?
Well, it's good. Yeah. I'm currently doing it. Queen Margaret's in the office. So every morning I come in really early and I try and fit myself into different spaces of the office because it's a process of me understanding literally where I fit. You know, I literally going, do I belong in this very formal environment? You know, like I do go ahead and I try and figure things out through my body first and then try and think about it later. Which often results in twisted ankles and sprained knees. And, but that's part of the learning.
Or possibly a colleague spotting you, finding you somewhere.
Yes. Yes. And usually
getting like quite,
yeah. Yeah. Very rarely getting stuck, but I'm appreciated when other colleagues are around to help me get out. Yeah.
Anthony, as I said, so time is flying and we'll soon come to our first pause and also a little bit of a listen to You have trouble in Paris. But before that, to relate back to where all this came from, and you already mentioned your travels and your different upbringing environments. Many of the listeners of this program share this, even through their feedback, share this experience of not knowing from day one it will become.
Yeah.
Somehow you also already hinted at this. You keep asking certain questions.
Yes.
I don't know. The travels, your different experiences also later on in Canada, in Europe. How much of that sort of helped keep you flexible on your toes?
I think it has to be. And I think, you know, and I think you're absolutely right. I talk to a lot of students who are graduating who think that they're going to take a degree and then they're going to do that for the rest of their lives. And, you know, life doesn't work that way. And it certainly hasn't worked with me. You know, I took a degree I finished my high school, thought I was going to become a geographer, took a writing class, thought, oh, this is really interesting, took a writing class, graduated writing, and then went to Kuwait to teach. And when I got there, they said, the teacher, the place where I was going to teach said, we don't need another English teacher, but we need an art teacher. Can you teach art? And I went, yes, sure. And that kind of pivoted me onto looking at art, which led me onto sort of social practice, which led me onto academics, which led me onto. So the notion that there's ever sort of a singular narrative, I think is really problematic. And I think what I would ever say to anyone is that, you know, you do what works and what's responding and what's interesting and you follow those bits. So yes, like a student going to university, you start with a very broad base. You find out the bits that interest you. You specialize. You go, you know, and that's kind of what life is like as well. You know, and I think my experience has maybe my interest in sort of being in the moment physically has allowed me a little bit more comfort in that. But I think if there's a probably greatest advantage that I've been put at is that because my earlier years were so, moving around, you know, because they were so unfixed, it means that I'm quite comfortable continuing to be unfixed. Yes. And so I think.
But not ignoring the spaces you're in.
Of course.
But breezing through them, but going in detail into the nooks and crannies. So.
It's about being responsive to them. It's about being with them, you know, and that's physical spaces, but it's also intellectual spaces and conceptual spaces and academic spaces. You know, what are the spaces that you are responding to? What are the thoughts that are interesting? What are the things that are the interesting but difficult questions? Those are the bits you stop at, and they may take you on a different path, and that's okay. It's more than okay. I think that's the best thing about life.
Anthony, as I said, we're sort of nearing the first poem. So I wonder whether you can help me introduce your first choice, your first track.
Yeah, I have three in my head, which I've been thinking about because I didn't know what I would make a distinction of until you asked me. I had a radio show when I was younger, and music has always been really essential to me. And I think I'm going to be a little bit radical, and I'm going to choose a song called Halcyon and On by Underworld. I'm a child of the ravers in the 90s, and it was a remix of one of the first digital songs ever made, which is called It's Gonna Be a Fine Day by Opus Blue, but it's called Halcyon and On and On.
Okay, let's have a listen to this. I'm also happy to share this on the program because it's maybe not the type of music, the genre, which one generally associates with our station and also this type.
Absolutely.
We're also trying to walk across borders. And
absolutely.
So that was really something, Anthony. And while you were listening to this, I'm listening to Anthony Schrack today on today's show of hopping between campuses and exchanging ideas on a global level on Campus FM. You were telling me how there's this particular connection you make to this type of music, because it takes you back to a period where the question of physicality is a bit questionable.
Yeah, you know, it was the rise of the Raver Society, which was really sort of the birth of the internet, which was a very disembodied notion. And yet at the same time, it was this very visceral dance culture. And so I kind of really wanted to kind of, I was thinking about that in that process of how do you look back at your life and the influences, and then how do you also then look forward? And those, that music really kind of drives me there. It pulls me back, but it also pulls me into the present.
Mm-hmm. Anthony, in the second part, in this middle section, I'd like to maybe to look a little bit more in detail into what you've been doing. Recently, as I said, your website covers quite a bit of your work, which is very physical. So even what you said, that explains a little bit the project you had, where you had people rolling down hills and holding hands and also engaging in what you describe as a sort of fight club. Mm-hmm. So there's a bit of that I'm really happy for you to share with our audience. But maybe my question is a bit from the outside, shall I say? Because in all of this, there is an audience. Or is there not? Because there's you, there's the community. Let's call them, for want of a better word, I don't really like the word, but sort of the subjects.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you also comment a bit ironically on how a researcher can actually be sort of using
his or
her own benefit. But then, is there an audience or is there?
Yes and no. And I think this is a problem we have in artistic or cultural frames, is that I think we assume that the audience is homogenous. And I think most people actually understand that it can be quite heterogeneous. And so the projects that I do with communities, you know, say, for example, that Fight Club project that I did, where I invited office people to fight in the basement, you know, the whole point of that was for them, you know, and it was about them finding new ways of interacting with each other. And it was very much about stepping them away from this very intellectual space and very kind of controlled environment, and then finding a new way to interact with their community. And so the event is for them. And that's absolutely clear. It's for them. It is useful to other audiences to reflect on how this idea can then be reflected on in different contexts of different people. And it could be put in a gallery, and it can be talked about in different contexts. And it can even be kind of presented in, you know, like change management in a corporate environment, going, oh, here's. So I think it's always plural. And I think when I work in a community context, I have very hesitantly call my work art. And I do that because I think most people have an idea of what art is. And I'm okay with that. And I'm okay to go into a community and say, hi, we're going to try and break the world record for the largest group of people holding hands. What is it? It's a thing where we're going to try to hold hands. That's it. Now, I can talk about it as art to other artists, to policy people, to funders as art, because I understand it's art, and I'm happy to talk about it as art to anyone else. But I don't ever want to complicate the notion that culture can ever be a singular thing. And I think that relates to that question you have of audience, is that oftentimes I think we present things as a platonic experience. Here is a idea that is totally acceptable by everyone in this culture, everyone in this community. That can't happen, and it doesn't happen. And even the most populist thing, there will be not types of audiences from. So I think in my work, the question of audience is quite a clear one, because it can be, for any project, it can be multiple. And I think the problem that occurs, especially from a policy context, is especially arts in a community will say, hello, X artist, go into this community and do a piece of artwork for them. Now, there's no such thing as community. There's communities, there's multiple publics, there's variety of different people. And actually, you know, Michael Bonner talks about this idea of counterpublics, that a public is always, a public always defines itself by itself. It isn't ever defined from an external point of view.
Mm-hmm.
So when we walk into a community, we kind of have to be understanding that we are talking to multiple groups of people who all have different ideas of what they want from the work and from the project. And so for a funder or an artist to want a singular utopian experience for everything is impossible, because we will then be, you know, I'm writing just a paper right now, and I use the example of, you know, Confederate sculptures or colonial sculptures in Britain, or Confederate sculptures in America. You know, those were presented as if it was a singular audience, and those singular experiences denied colonization, denied slavery, denied all those sorts of things. So in a public realm, it will always be multiple. And I like that. I think that's wonderful. What I think the role of the artist is to encourage that multiplicity, to not assume that there is a homogeneous experience of people.
Mm-hmm. Anthony, when you explain it this way, and when you also speak from obviously your own perspective, which you've developed over years of practice and reflection, you sort of craft a narrative which puts things, let's say, neatly, somewhat neatly. What happens when in fact you're designing, drafting, maybe even negotiating? Because you might have people who are not really interested.
Yeah.
Others who might not really not get it, but not want to get it because they couldn't. And you mentioned funders.
Yeah.
I'm sure you can also get colleagues sort of across the spaces we inhabit. We would want on our side, but you can't manage to do that. And maybe others also who are very invested and but see it from a different perspective. So while there is all this diversity, however, in order to come up with the productions, let's call them productions, that you do come up with, things have to click. They have to click together. It's a bit like an opera or a film. It's not simply sitting down writing a paper.
No.
It's very, very multifaceted.
Yeah.
So how do people, I want to ask you, how do you do it and how you go together? But how do people actually relate to not knowing?
Yeah.
That's
a really difficult question, you know? Yeah. And I think you mentioned at the beginning of this question, you know, this idea that I've created I present a very accessible narrative. I think it's true that most people or artists do that. You know, whenever I do an artist talk, I present something that's quite clear. In the living of it, it is never that clear. And I just want young people or anyone who's listening to this to recognize that no one is that clear. It's always a mess. But you know, you asked this question about how it could work where multiple stakeholders, we'll call them that, can kind of come around something. And someone once said to me, you know, Anthony, how, I know I'm a good painter because I can paint and I can, I can represent something and that's fine. How do I know I'm a good socially engaged artist?
Huh.
And I had to say, it's the same thing. The clue is in the title. You socially engage. You know, you literally, if you have to talk to people. And so oftentimes that is then kind of coming up with a concept that is, let's say, woolly enough, or let's say it's flexible enough where for you it can mean something, but for something it can mean something different. But you both are agreeing on that same moment. And that comes with a lot of dialogue and debate and discussion. So, you know, for example, I did a project in Vancouver years ago about a park where there were many different stakeholders in this park. There were people who walked the dog. There were people who, you know, looked at birds. There were people that fished. There were people that did whatever. And so what I tried to do was create some form of conflict between these people as a way to talk about ownership. So ownership was the subject, but these multiple different people then could say what they felt about it, but did it in a forum by which they understood that was happening in many different ways. But it also then related to the funders who wanted a certain thing, but also related to, you know, policymakers who were thinking about how to encourage different ways of engagement to this park. So it isn't clear, but it's always a negotiation. it's always a dialogue that, that happens in a process. And I think the role of an artist is to come up with something that is suitably loose, but suitably clear, that many things can fit through it. It's almost like having, you know, you're almost like walking around with a frame that's empty, and you can literally say, everyone can look through this frame and they will see a different thing, but the frame will be the same for all of them.
Mm-hmm. So would maybe that frame somehow represent the role of the artist or arts or the creative element? Because, for example, at the University of Malta, I help out with some research on a project run by Professor Rayford Vella, who heads currently the sort of adult education and community-oriented arts at the Faculty of Education. And the question of whether a social project is also art, mm-hmm. the artist somehow is doubling up and becoming mm-hmm. a socially engaged person, almost like a social worker. Mm-hmm. And on this idea of what the roles are. And somehow the whole dimension of conflict between people may be hard, as you were explaining, to say, should one try to identify and even distinguish between roles, or is that frame enough?
Yeah, to me, it depends on I suppose the levels of engagement that you have with groups of people. You know, I've a lot of respect for Raphael's work and for generally social practice. But my question that I always have about social practice, which is maybe relates to this question of the frames, is it being politics? Are you trying to persuade someone to believe the same types of politics that you are? Because as soon as you're trying to do this, that won't work. And you know, the question about artist as a social worker is a really complicated thing. You know, a social worker is appropriately trained. They have skills and understandings. They have links and networks between agencies like the police and healthcare. They have, there's a right way to be a social worker. There is not a right way to be an artist. And so that to me becomes problematic when we start talking about collapsing those ideas together. Rather, the frame becomes that question. And so there's no right answer, or there's no right overarching answer. There might be individual right answers, but that frame is enough to sort of hold everyone's attention mm-hmm. to that project. And then the artistic work, so to speak, is the multiple, not just outputs, not just products, but the outcomes of thinkings. You know, I always go back to that idea that that art is the thing that challenges our perceptual habits, which is what this Canadian artist Liz Migor suggests. She says art is the thing that challenges the way we think about the world. So if we can come up with a frame that challenges us to think about the world, whatever we come up with those answers, that's fine because we've thought about them. But we may have different thoughts about them, but we have thought.
Yes, and somehow it's more of a challenge because within communities from white and maybe even the third section will start soon after this second pause. Sometimes communities undergoing or experiencing mm-hmm. conflict mm-hmm. actually would prefer stability, clarity, mm-hmm. Answers rather than opening up things again.
Yeah.
Questioning things all over again. Sometimes settling for something which might not be very exciting, but sometimes in certain areas of conflict, stability and not asking too much is sought after. So that's a bit of a tension there.
And that is absolutely correct. And I think that's absolutely, you know, my interest in conflict is not to go around and, excuse me if I use, you know, swearing words, but is to not to go around and fuck everything up. Like that's not my intention in conflict. My interest in conflict is going, where are there positions where voices are not heard? Where are there contexts by which there is not an equality of discussion? You know, where are there notions? You know, I use it as my grandmother problem. I use it in my lecturing all the time. You know, my grandmother, bless her, 4'5", you know, tiny woman, hair like the queen. She would have thrown herself into a bus to protect me. She loved me fiercely. She would have done anything to protect me. But she was also a racist conservative. So she's not a bad person, and it's not my job as an artist to shut her down. My job as an artist is to find an understanding where she might be able to reflect about something in the same way that my niece, who's, you know, a left-wing punk, could both reflect on a similar thing. They will have different understandings and they will have different desires out of those things. But if we can then kind of find a way to, I don't mean bring them together to solve the problem. That's not what I mean. But if we could find a way for us to reflect on these things together, then that's a much more effective way than trying to actually make everyone believe the same sort of idea. You know, I don't want to make a leftist utopia because a utopia is not a nice place to live.
You've hinted at this, sort of the how a utopia becomes a dystopia because sort of by force of trying too much, engages in instruction, maybe education or
and
one misses the point then.
And as Rosalind Deutsch suggests, you know, like division and instability are the conditions of democracy. They are not antithetical to democracy. They are the democracy is a place where there is discourse and disagreement. That is democracy. So actually, if we want to have a space that is dialogic, democratic, all those sorts of things, then that's the role of the artist, is to encourage that. That might mean necessarily engaging people who have different political ideologies to you. Your job is not to make them like you. Your job is to understand and to bring those voices together.
Anthony, we're almost two-thirds in now, so it's time for the second track that you would like to share with us.
Thank you. So I was thinking about, I suppose, the things that are currently interesting me and the things that, moving on to the last bit about research, and a friend of mine has released an album, and he has developed a song called Moonlit River, and it's just stuck in my head on play, and I really love it. And so I'm not going to give it too much justification other than say it's beautiful.
That's good enough. Let's listen to it.
I never knew a place could act like you do. It spits down on me, it's rhythm and blues. The cold west wind chills me through and through. It carries me up and away from you. Somewhere out on the moonlight river, there is a man on the floor. We'll take him up, dry him down, and send him off to face our fears. Holding on in the rain, I wouldn't have stayed if I knew. You undress, but I have something that I think you deserve. It's coming over me and it can't be seen or heard. Somewhere out on the moonlight river, there is a man on the floor. Take him up and dry him down,
So thanks, Anthony Shrugg, my guest today on the program, for sharing that track as well. I feel it was sort of letting us in on quite a personal journey. It's nice when people share favorite tracks and track by their friends. It gives something personal. So to come to the last part of this program, again, so we're shifting between many spaces. There's the personal, there's the public, and there's the areas of conflict. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask you, was conflicts and art and conflicts have become, I'll use the word trendy, because mm-hmm. you see courses and you see programs, and there's sort of a lot of interest being paid to how to somehow address, if not even resolve, conflict through some creative process. It could be the place, or it could be something like a war zone, and send people who are trained in a particular culture, in a particular language, to try to resolve an issue, a bit like the books. The Lawrence approach to trying to understand and resolve it in other cultures. Would you agree that it's become a bit of like a trendy thing to do? And maybe would you see some pitfalls in sort of popularizing and maybe banalizing this type of approach?
Yes. Yes, it's become trendy, and yes, it's problematic. I think my interest in conflict doesn't lie to the extreme ends, you know, war zones and those sorts of ideas. I'm not interested in, and nor am I interested in solving conflict or using it. I'm actually interested in what you would call pro-social conflict, and that's about going back to what I referred to kind of in the last section about democracy being a place of discourse. So I think the pitfalls of artists kind of working within those extreme conflicts, shall we say, go back to that referencing of what I was talking about as an artist, as a social worker. You know, we're not trained to understand those contexts. We have this understanding of what, a good artist should do. And I think that is really, problematic to assume that necessarily an artist can be helpful in those contexts. I'm not sure an artist should ever be helpful. Because to be helpful, we have to kind of know what we're working towards. You know, it's that question of when we try to make things better, under what conditions are we defining better? And generally that comes with quite a sort of colonial notion. So, you know, where are we colonizing other people's idea of what better is? And I think generally we are. My interest in, I suppose, in conflict lies in what are those pro-social conflicts? And those are in contexts by which they're usually a little bit more boring spaces, you know, generally Western spaces, generally not, you know, but maybe in the West we have just a harder time being comfortable with conflict. And so that's the bit that I'm interested in, because it's about power. And so I'm interested in how specifically cultural power is manifesting. So I'm currently doing a research project with the Perthshire Museum and Art Gallery up here. It's kind of been on pause because of COVID, but we're hoping to go back next month. But it's looking at how is this museum a public museum, you know. So if it is a public museum, it's owned by the state, which is actually means that it's owned by the people. The people own this museum collection. So if the people own this collection, surely the people have to have a say in what is there and what it does. But I don't think that is happening. And actually what's happening is that the museum, not as a bad way, but just because it's their job, they're being gatekeepers about what should be kept and what shouldn't kept. So the premise that I have for them is that what if we open that up to the entirety of the public? And what if we, as a provocation, and I'm really clear to kind of underline the provocational nature as opposed to the actual nature. So what if we provoke people and say, the people must come to a conclusion of what is the least important object, and then we must destroy that object. And the provocation is there to kind of unpick this idea that actually what different people, different groups will think of as least important will be different. And so when you put that in conflict with each other, it starts to unpick, well, what are the values of the group? And what are the values and understanding of these wider fields? And what are the understandings of the power within that? And that's the art, that's the frame, right? Going mm-hmm. back to what we were saying, because that's the thing that we're looking through. So the provocation of destruction acts as a way to do this, what I call pro-social conflict, which brings relationships of power, relationships of civil society, relationships of values, into a productive discussion, as opposed to shutting something down and going, well, we're the museum, we own everything, and we make the right decisions because we're experts. They are experts. They know exactly what they're talking about. But I don't know if that then necessarily opens up a good relationship with the broader public. Mm-hmm. So I'm interested in kind of using that interest in the public and actually, you know, going all the way back to the visceral to start about physicality. Yes. You know, that's a visceral thing. That's a visceral thing of going, being around the objects, touching the objects. What is the most, what is the least important? What does it mean if we destroy something? That's a kind of embodied response. And that's kind of, I suppose, where I'm interested in putting those things in relationship with each other. Because I think when we talk about conflict in those extreme settings, as I mentioned, they come with a whole bunch of power dynamics, which I don't think artists can be useful in. Whereas, in their own context, relating into the field of culture, I think we can be quote unquote useful by asking those difficult questions.
Right, right. We're nearing the end of this conversation, Anthony. And you've already hinted at where somehow you're going, but again, in a very open-ended way.
Yeah.
So saying sort of ideally, or maybe that's the nature of artistic projects, not putting the cart before the horse.
Yeah.
While with social projects or maybe very clear economically driven projects, one needs to have a clear idea of where one's to end up. With other type of approaches and projects, one needs to sort of have an idea of where one is going, but not predetermine that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you can be smart. I think people can be smart in that, and you can have. I suppose my interest in a longer term does start relate to these collections and these sites, these institutions. And I think I will be kind of regularly exploring that for a long period of time to come. But you can be smart in going, well, I'm going to do a smaller bit and I'm going to frame a bit of a conversation. Mm-hmm. I have no idea what's going to happen with that later on, but you can be clear and go, okay, for the next 6 months, I can do that. And I don't know what the outcome is, but I know that will lead on to other things. And so again, it goes back to what we're saying about being responsive to those sites and those experiences, both those intellectual sites and those cultural sites. So I think I do this project and that's an interesting thing. And it will inevitably, like you mentioned, lead in some writing and some reflection, but it will inevitably lead me to another step. And I don't know what that's going to be, but mm-hmm. we'll probably be in the same direction.
Anthony, we hinted at this earlier when we spoke about the music we listen to and the digital dimension. After all, this recording is happening online.
Yeah.
You're in Edinburgh, I'm in Malta. And you did mention and hint at the digital dimension, which has been with us for mm-hmm. years. But somehow, I think in our experience, we might experience the digital connectivity, the ability to connect with each other somehow as less of a bridge and more of a wall, because you might feel that they are communicating just because they're on an online call,
mm-hmm.
because they're watching something or a game, which however is very different from an experience where one is in a place
mm-hmm.
with a particular temperature, with a particular natural condition. Oh, and also possibly really, really asking questions, as you do, for example, with the sheep lecture.
Yeah.
Where you're taking on issues of colonialism and history and context spaces.
Yeah.
Addressing an audience of sheep.
Yeah.
But somehow trying to deal with big issues.
Yeah.
A very natural environment, but then also somehow using the digital dimension. Not to split yourself off and cut yourself off from the audience,
yeah.
but to try to get closer.
Yeah.
I know maybe it's a complex and also maybe a bit of an unclear question when I'm trying to put together in conclusion. How do you see the digital element, which sometimes is making us lazy and too comfortable within our space, rather than go out and try to engage in spaces which make uncomfortable?
Yeah, I think in some ways you're very right in that sense. I think what we have to think of the digital is a tool, a limited tool. You know, I think it does do really interesting things. And I think it has shown that, you know, I don't have to fly to Malta to have an interview with you. And I think these sorts of things are wonderful. And in terms of social impacts to climate change, I think we can feel good about those things. But I do think we should be very wary about assuming that this tool is the be all and end all, you know. And I think that the true understandings of something, I think, you know, for example, Zoom is, or any kind of video conferencing call is a great way to sustain relationships, but I'm not sure it's a great way to develop relationships.
Mm.
So maybe I do need to be in the heat with you to understand that. And then I can come back to Edinburgh and we can continue talking about this, but I can't truly understand that unless I physically feel it, unless I'm physically there. So a bit like we were talking about, you know, the at the start about the physical then leading to the academic and the reflective. You have to take all of these together. You know, it's again like the audience as well, is that there's no singular way. And I would hate for the world to then be presented as only digital or only physical.
That would be rather flat. And just to conclude in the last couple of minutes, it somehow makes me reflect also on the, maybe even the traditional education setup, which has questions about whether people should be learning online.
Yeah, totally.
Of somehow developing more of the online skills because that's what we need later on, even in a workplace or keeping communication going. I like how you distinguish between maybe the difference between maintaining relations, at least, maybe even reconnecting, or the developing them and nurturing them, which needs more than that.
Yeah, I agree. Totally. Yeah, thank you.
We'll see how things pan out then. And
definitely.
Soon we'll be able to meet each other physically again.
That would be wonderful.
Engage with audiences and with even students.
That would be great.
Because I'm aware that even people sort of practicing their craft and their art have had a tough time.
Definitely.
With doing that because of restrictions. But I'm not.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much for being with me.
Carsten, thank you. That I really enjoyed that. It was really lovely to connect with you again and for those very interesting questions. Thank you.
And I also thank our listeners for being with us and heartily refer them to your website.
Ah, thank you.
Your writings online and your projects, because in a way they can see, they might be really part of it and engage as part of it, but see at least and reflect a little bit on some of the very interesting points that you...
That would be great. Yeah.
Thank you, Anthony.
Thank you very much.
It's a little intervista or a bit calm that's came or a ghost name of Aina for a second half nectar. Il-stajna najdu imma daku li laħħaqna għadna. Jekk tridu tkunu tafu ktar dwaru fiċċuħ online, anki s-sis tijaw stess, id-dikom idea tal-personalità tijaw. Konna nitkellem ma' Anthony Schrag u dan il-program huwa minn kampus għal-ieħor. Nistidinkom tkunu miegħi il-ġimgħa d-dieħla.